And we are engaged in this hour in such a reflection about the attempted insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th this last year. Many argue that it started with the big lie. And we have been following along with voices who joined us in those early days. Before the break, we finished a conversation with presidential advisor David Gergen and Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. And one of the last things they talked about was accountability. Well, over the last 12 months, hundreds have been arrested and charged in connection with the insurrection, including nearly a dozen from New England, six from Massachusetts. And yet that's a fraction of those who breached the Capitol that day. And as investigations by law enforcement and Congress continue, it's become clear that there was coordination and planning, at least by and for some of the participants behind that breach of the Capitol. So we want to finish on accountability. Join the conversation. Have enough and have the right people been held accountable for what happened on the 6th? Will they be? What happens if they aren't? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. With us now about what the future may hold and accountability in the moment. First, we have Joan Donovan, research director at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy, who is an expert on extremism. Joan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Andrew Lelling, former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts in the Trump administration. Lelling coordinated with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia on prosecutions. Andrew, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, good to be here.
So, Joan, I'm going to start here this with a statement from Congressman Jake Auchincloss, speaking at an event hosted by the Charles River Regional Chamber last night. Here it is.
This is not a day to be consecrated and inscribed into the history books and reflected upon and speechified about. This is current events. This is happening now. We are in the middle of a constitutional crisis where the majority of the GOP thinks that the election was stolen in 2020.
Are we in the middle of something, Joan? And if so, what do you think it is?
We've been in the middle of something, and that's sadly the reality of the political situation. You know, for those who are listening, I research internet communication and the ways in which disinformation, misinformation travels, and it's really hit a fever pitch over the last couple of years. But especially as we talk about elections, and it goes all the way from the local to the national, and even globally, we're seeing these trends where those who have control of the communication infrastructure can set pretty well different kinds of political and public agendas. And so we have to reflect on the fact that, yes, it's currently happening. And the more that people who are fed lies and disinformation that already believe that the election has been stolen, they're ready to mobilize. They're ready to do something about it. January 6th, unfortunately, was just the first shot across the bow.
Andrew Lelling is somebody who really recently was charged with, you know, law enforcement, prosecuting if people make such attempts, stopping things from happening. What do you think when you hear Joan Donovan react like that?
Well, I've got two sort of general observations. One is that of the people who breached the Capitol back in January of 2021, they should be prosecuted down to the last man or woman. The rule of law has to prevail, and I think the department's doing a pretty good job of doing that. Looking ahead, my predictions are slightly less dire. I think it's easy to forget that the people who breached the Capitol that day were an extremely self-selected set of supporters of President Trump. You know, that was a Stop the Steal rally. People traveled from far and wide. Think about the level of motivation needed to show up in the first place. And then some even more extreme subset of that group breached the Capitol. And so while the event is appalling, I do not extrapolate to the public as a whole from that event. I think that people like us obsess about these events. I think most of the country, frankly, is past it. I don't think that formal proceedings in Washington are going to change that. So I think most of the public may be slightly out of sync with us. I think most of the public thinks that it was terrible, but is not worried on a day-to-day basis about it happening again. And I think in a very preliminary way, The recent elections, both of which were close, in Virginia and New Jersey, which proceeded without violence and without loud cries of fraud afterward, I think give you a little bit of hope that things will return somewhat back to normal in that regard.
Joan Donovan, let me just let you react to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's unfortunately, in the research that we do, I do agree that it is a small but highly, highly engaged and coordinated group of people that set about that day knowing they were going to storm the Capitol. And when you get large crowds of people with other, frankly, let's call them insurrectionists, amidst, they do, you know, use the cover of the crowd to do such things. But we saw with the Stop the Steal crowd several attempts to storm other state capitals and to get inside and to disrupt votes in the lead up to this. And what we know about social movements is they have these moments of abeyance. There's going to be, they're going to be tied up in court cases. They're going to be using more clandestine communication apps like Telegram, but they are, you know, in our estimation, the research that we're doing, they're very angry, and they do see other, not just elections, but other opportunities in the future to come back together stronger. What's missing right now, of course, is Trump from the discourse, and Trump was able to animate so much belief that, he could change the winds of the election if more people showed up at the Capitol. We are missing that component. It's very important for social movements to have, a political person on the inside that makes them think they can win. And so until such time that we see things tilt in that favor, and I'm not saying things go back to Republicans, I'm saying it's Trump, right? Trump is a very unique fixture in this part of our political world. And so I'm cautious, but not as optimistic.
So I seven different directions I want to go at once. Andrew Lilling, I'm going to turn back to you, and I want to ask you, in investigating people who participated and in prosecuting, you know, Joan is painting a very specific picture here based on the research she's done. I'm also struck by the sort of party bus attitude that we saw, among some of the participants as well. I'm thinking about the coverage of Mark Sahadi and Suzanne Ayani, members of Super Happy Fun America, who are two of the people who prosecuted from Massachusetts. You know, buses heading down there. This continuum of America, some seeing this as one of the most abhorrent moments in our American history, and others seeing it as an opportunity to be a part of something. How does one draw the distinction between that and criminality in prosecuting, especially among local participants from the New England area?
Well, it is, the situation has its complexities, but I think you have to keep in mind that before the event, no one anticipated that happening except for a tiny fraction of true militant extremists who went down there hoping for violence and looking for ways to make it happen. So all the people piling onto the buses, they just think they're going to a rally. They don't think they're going down there to participate in a seminal criminal event. And I think that's important to keep in mind. Now, those who, despite going down there just thinking they're participating in a rally, but wind up participating in the breach of the Capitol, they should be prosecuted. They are, adults with personal agency. They're responsible for their own behavior, and they should be prosecuted. But, the party atmosphere was perfectly understandable at the time. You had a lot of people on the Republican side who believed that the election was illegitimate. And so going down there to express that publicly with Trump leading the way with a speech made perfect sense, if that was your belief. And it's only after the fact that it looks insane to have done so.
So I want to go to the phones for a second. 1-800-423-8255. We'll hear from Nick in Natick. Nick, go ahead.
Hi. I've got two things that are working together. Basically, it seems like there's a standard of what they allow to be said on TV. whether it's commercials or news, has really gone down. And basically, people can lie. I remember when I was a kid, if you saw a commercial that wasn't true, they would pull it off the air. You might see it once, and then you wouldn't be able to see that commercial again. And I think that mixed with social media and just the echo chamber and what people are consuming, I don't know how we get away from that, how this doesn't just keep intensifying like it's been doing the last several years.
Thanks for that call, Nick. I don't know that the laws around commercials and falsification of information on commercials have changed, but Joan Donovan, certainly the spread of misinformation via social media is something that we are really dealing with now. How important is the social space, and how has that changed? Go.
Yeah, Nick is absolutely right. Nick understands, on cable and broadcast especially, you had to be very careful. This is why we saw Lou Dobbs, for instance, have to walk back his comments about the big lie. We saw Newsmax have to make an apology after airing an interview with Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy. So if you in media make an apology or a retraction, like we see at the back page of the paper, then that's considered okay. You've made good. But with social media, of course, you can say anything you want. And so then you start to see this gray area where if you're on the news and you're just quoting someone on social media, that's reporting news. And, and maybe the quote sounds like news, but it's really planting misinformation and disinformation into more public arenas. And so you've seen some people try to get more accountability around that by saying, hey, we want our news to be free from this kind of political influence. But unfortunately, it's really hard to hold anybody to account. And I know that's the theme of this moment on the show. And unfortunately, social media really changes the game for how reporting is done.
And does it change the game for how prosecution is done, Andrew Lelling? You know, we have six people in Massachusetts charged in connection with January 6th. One of those cases, Brian McCreary, is closed. How does social media fit into prosecution, investigation?
I can say from the prosecution side, social media is a huge problem. Social media has absolutely turbocharged extremist movements and has contributed to political polarization by allowing people to simply choose what they are going to consume when it comes to news. And that could be reliable news, not reliable news. They can choose precisely what fits their own philosophical predilections. And so they're all in their own little bubbles, and it's easier than ever to coordinate with fellow extremists online. We've seen that over the course of several years on the law enforcement side, how rapidly extremist groups coalesce and then can coordinate their actions. And when I was the United States Attorney, I'd often felt like you were a referee, meaning you would see this constant barrage of hostile commentary on social media, and you had to decide what crossed the line into an actionable threat, something that was a crime, and what was just political commentary in our ever-coarsening environment. That was very difficult to do, and over the last few years, you can see some of the choices we made in that regard. But social media is a tremendous issue when it comes to monitoring threats to the public and trying to figure out what to do with them.
So, Joan Donovan, picking up on two things that Andrew Lelling just said, he talked about social media turbocharging these movements, and also, there's a line of judgment about what crosses over. So I wonder, one, reflect on the turbocharging, and I know you've done a lot of work recently on memes and their role in turbocharging messages. And two, are those who are really organizing with nefarious intent, are they savvy about that line? Do they know how to walk up to it and not cross it?
Yeah, they certainly know how to create a market for information. And so if you think about things like build the wall, lock her up, jobs not mobs, stop the steal, release the Kraken, they all have similar things in common, which is that they're memes, they're all three-word phrases, some of them rhyme, And the point of that is to make it memorable. And to, you know, the point of coordination, though, what it does is it allows these extremist groups to find each other online, similar to the way that other movements like Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter or Standing Rock have been able to organize online. However, what we see that's different about these extremist groups is they will go really above and beyond to be incredibly resilient to platform moderation. They will know not to use certain racial slurs. They will create their own language and their own sets of phrases in order to make sure and also create backup channels so that they can stay on the more public platforms like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. And then they'll often be running a side chat, you know, on a less well-known service like Zello, for instance. Which there was some great reporting on by WNYC and Michael Loewinger. And unfortunately, we're in this multi-platform environment where law enforcement is going to have to look across all of these spaces to do their monitoring. But the general public might not even know that they're immersed in groups online that contain extremists that are coordinating right under the cover. And unfortunately, when we see organization of groups like Stop the Steal, they track right back to folks like Roger Stone and Steve Bannon. And so we're
former Trump advisors.
Former Trump advisors. And we're in this moment where we're trying to think about, well, what is our online world going to look like after January 6th of last year? I think that moment, January 6th, was an incredibly important moment in internet history. Because that's when platform companies really went, at these accounts, and they removed a ton of these accounts. But unfortunately, it doesn't necessarily break up the groups because they're planning for that already.
So, Andrew Lelling, we have about 30 seconds left. Most important step over the next year in accountability for January 6th.
The most important step in accountability is being taken already, which is that the Justice Department, continues to aggressively prosecute everyone involved. Those cases have been proceeding as they should. The sentences have made sense. And at the end of that process, the department should release to the public statistics and figures about who was prosecuted, how many convictions, and what they got. That's what the public wants to see. And I think so far has confidence in that process as it's been going on. So hopefully that will continue.
All right. That is Andrew Lelling, former U.S. Attorney for Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Joan Donovan, Research Director at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Policy. Thank you, Joan.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beland. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. Thanks for listening and calling today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.